I think before I dive into the message portion of today, I need to tell you about one of the times I spoke in a church in the mountains of Peru. It was an exchange, a trade of sorts, if you will. This was back in the time when I was on my world race, the 11-month missions trip that went to 11 different countries, and I spent 1 month in each country serving alongside a variety of ministries and nonprofit organizations. And my team was in our 10th month of ministry. We were seasoned speakers, and we were often put on the spot for speaking or singing special songs for local churches. The Lord I Need You song is actually one that we often came back to. But this situation was a little different and definitely one I won't forget. We were driving in a two-vehicle convoy up to Yanacancha, a village remote in the mountains of Peru, and I was in the second car of the convoy when all at once the car in front veered suddenly around this corner, and it, like, stopped abruptly. And turns out a man had been struck by the first car. Somehow, in this remote area, a crowd of men all are surrounding this incident, and I decided that I needed to be there, so I get out and I run over to assess the situation, and we find out this man is going to live. He had just hit his leg quite hard and had fallen over a tree. No big deal. He was fine. But the local church leader had to take him back to the city to make sure he was okay. And as we prepared to leave in our vehicle to go on to where we were going, an older gentleman comes over to the driver's side of our vehicle and says to the pastor and asks if the sisters, is what we were often called as a group of women, could come share at their church that evening, as it seemed appropriate considering the circumstance. So we were picked up that evening, and 45 minutes later, we walked back to the scene of the crime, and I shared a message on the fruits of the Spirit, specifically peace, to a church only because we had hit a man from their community. So I'll leave you wondering what might have happened here this week that I was invited to share today. We're continuing on in our Verses to Memorize series this morning, and I should let you know a bit about a misunderstanding I had when it came to this series at first. I thought we were picking apart passages from the Bible that we misunderstood or misconstrued in the church, like how we read that we shouldn't pierce our ears or women shouldn't cut their hair, men shouldn't shave their beards, but it really means we can do all those things. So I decided to focus on that particular Old Testament passage as my very first, very controversial message delivered at West Heights. I'm kidding. I've chosen a passage that has always struck me at my core on my own journey, and each time I come back to it, I see new insights, new truths that I'm reminded of. I've sung songs to a variety of beats, created actions to the verses, and I'm excited to share on Psalm 139 this morning. Many of you will have heard this psalm before, maybe even sung along with me at some point, and portions of this passage are used frequently in a variety of contexts. But there you have it. You're starting to learn, know some things and facts about me. Some of you have seen me in my high points, like when I was a corn costume last week. Many of you have seen me around, and some of you have known me since before I was even born. Today, we're going to focus on a psalm that explores what it means to be known by God. The Book of Psalms is sometimes referred to as the Psalter. It's a book that many connect with, and sometimes we find our most loved passages or verses from. We have the classic 23rd Psalm, and if you were here last week, you would have heard Charlie Mashinter's message on that psalm and the call to rest that we can take away from it. Psalm 23 can be used in life celebration services, and as kids, we might have memorized it in places like Sunday school or VBS. There are 150 poems, we sometimes call them chapters, that cover a range of emotions in the Book of Psalms. We see love and worship to God, we see sorrow in regards to sin, we see dependence on God in desperate times, the struggle of fear and trust, walking with God in the murky and dark areas, we see thankfulness to God for his care, devotion to his word, and we can find passages on assurance and confidence in him. The title itself of the book that we're familiar with in English comes from the Greek word salmos. My Greek is pretty fluent, meaning mizmor in Hebrew, which translates to English as songs. And the Hebrew word tehillim, or praises, describes these songs as praises offered to God in public worship. The Book of Psalms has a variety of authors, but 73 of the 150 have a Psalm of David inscription that suggests that David is the author. And while the majority of the Psalms are devotional and tend to be songs of praise or thanksgiving and adoration, there is prophetic elements in the book as well. It has been quoted in the New Testament about 100 times. A feature to remember as we navigate Psalm 139 this morning is the content of the psalm as poetic idiom. There will be images, metaphors that will contribute to the way in which the psalmist is experiencing their world. And in this case today, it's David. Understanding this will help us lean into the passage well this morning. And hopefully this brief overview of the book as is will also help us as we dive into this particular song of David. I once had a good friend tell me they believe there are two things people desire in life, and that is to be known and to know others, to feel known and seen, and also to be seen and known by other people. Our verse of the day, as noted in your sermon notes, is the last two verses of Psalm 139. We're going to be perusing the entire chapter this morning, but to get us thinking about what this all may entail, let's glance at the focal verses at the end of the chapter before we go back to the beginning. Psalm 139, 23 to 24 says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you, and lead me along the path of everlasting love." I'm excited. Look at that bold invitation the psalmist makes, inviting God to delve into the deepest parts and point out to him any areas that might need some cleaning or polishing. I don't speak these words lightly. We're going to sift through what leads and prompts David to get to a place of honest invitation to God to search his heart and grow him. In doing so, we might find ourselves wanting to invite God to search us in similar ways. The word know, K-N-O-W, appears in this 24-verse psalm 8 times. It's a pretty dominant theme throughout. So we're going to rewind a bit back to the beginning of this chapter. Psalm 139 begins with an exploration of all that God knows. And Psalm 139, 1 through 6 says, "O Lord, you have examined my heart and know everything about me. You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel and when I rest at home. You know everything I do. You know what I'm going to say even before I say it, Lord. You go before me and follow me. You place your hand of blessing on my head. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too great for me to understand." The all-knowing or omniscience attribute of God is in full effect here. My good friend Merriam-Webster, defines omniscience as having infinite awareness, understanding, and insight. Omniscience is one of the attributes of God. We would say it's not a communicable attribute, meaning we don't possess this quality of God. Hand in hand with God's omnipresence, that he is everywhere, and qualities like his invisibility, or his immutability, that he is unchanging, are qualities that only God has that we aren't able to be communicated or we don't get. But this omniscience, or all-knowing, is the frank reality that God knows it all. It's in the knowing of the inward thoughts, but also the external aspects of the psalmist's life, too. This leads us to our first point, if you're following along on the sermon notes or on the app, that God's knowledge is inescapable. He knows the outward. He sees the sitting, the standing, the travel, the work, the lying down, and he knows the inward. He sees the thinking, the heart, the words that David plans on saying. He knows all that there is to know about his people. I find it interesting that David himself, who was a king holding a high place among his people, is not exempt from this search. The hearts of kings in the times of the Bible were not subject to their, or were not searchable to their subjects. So Proverbs 25:3 says that this fact that no one can comprehend the height of heaven, the depth of the earth, or all that goes on in the king's mind. Yet David is recognizing here that God is and has searched his heart. His heart is still subject to the Creator. There's not one person who has high enough qualifications to be exempt from his knowing, not even the queen. Verse 6 wraps up this portion of the passage with an exclamation that this knowledge that God holds about humanity is too wonderful for the psalmist, almost too much for him to understand. I mean, I get it. There can be pros and cons to being known inwardly and outwardly by the God of the universe, when nothing you do is really outside of his knowing. The fact that I scarfed down and ate handfuls of M&Ms that I stole from a missionary in Venezuela kept me feeling so exposed for so long. He knew. I asked for forgiveness every night. The fact that God knew exactly where I was as I lay on the floor in the middle of a Zambian village, afraid as I heard gunfire from a domestic situation that was happening outside, kept me feeling safe and secure. God's all-knowing of our lives can feel a bit overwhelming or so comforting depending on where our hearts are at. There may be moments where we like it or where we're not really comforted by it. Yet the opposite of being known doesn't really bring warm, fuzzy feelings either. An antonym to the word known is unidentified or anonymous. I would much rather be identified and known, in spite of my shortcomings and theft problems, than to be unidentified or unknown or unfamiliar to God. The awe-inspiring admiration of how much God knows isn't a foreign concept throughout the scriptures either. Paul, in his letter to the Romans, notes it well in chapter 13, verse 33, and he says, "Oh, how great are God's riches in wisdom and knowledge. How impossible it is for us to understand his decisions and his ways." One can be wary of this fact, worried, just plain baffled. It's outside of our human finiteness to understand his infinite knowledge. David's processing the extent of God's persistent knowledge of his every hour. Getting away from this divine knowing is impossible. David can ignore it, he can pretend like God isn't aware, but that doesn't stop God from knowing. David moves into describing where he could go to get away from this knowing. He's processing the inescapability and beginning to realize what all it entails. We're going to move into the next section of the passage here, Psalm 139, 7 through 12. And it says, "I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I go down to the grave, you are there. If I ride the wings of the morning, if I dwell by the furthest oceans, even there your hand will guide me and your strength will support me. I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in darkness I cannot hide from you. To you the night shines as bright as day. Darkness and light are the same to you." God's presence reaches the furthest most places we could imagine. There's not a place that David could go where God will not be. His hand will guide and support the psalmist wherever he chooses to be. God's knowledge of our whereabouts is persistent, surrounding in a protective manner that no matter where we find ourselves, getting home after a long day at work, delivering a message on a Sunday morning, he knows what is happenstancing and is gently moving through our days with us. His knowledge is inescapable like a surveillance camera that's just persistently watching. It's kind of a weird thought to think about. God's knowledge is also protection. We see that there's no place that a person can move away from God and he not know. The psalmist will not be abandoned whether he goes to the furthest place he can, if it's the furthest coast of Canada to the west or Canada to the east. I appreciate the imagery that of darkness in this section of the passage, that darkness cannot even hide from God because night is like day to God. If only little Christina knew, then I might not have needed that extra nightlight. God's knowledge of us is inescapable. It's protective, and it's so broad, yet so detailed, too. This is highlighted more deeply in the next few verses of our passage that we're going to read. Verse 13 to 16 says, "You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the dark of the womb. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed." God's knowledge of us is intricate, detailed, and it began before we were created. He formed and sheltered each of us before we were born in the womb, or I guess we were born out of the womb. I've always been drawn to this section of the passage for the powerful image it provides. The psalmist is describing a moment none of us are privy to experience. The vivid imagery used by the psalmist, who also wasn't present at the time, denotes a caring, crafty God who spent time detailing the way each of us was made, intricately, complexly, marvelously. He knows. He knows that much, not just because he was there, but because he did it himself. Whether we were told we were conceived by accident or adopted after birth, God was not in the mix of creating mishaps. We were all distinctly crafted, woven, similar to a grandmother taking great care in the detail of a blanket that she knits for a grandchild, with care by a God who saw us unformed and knew we would grow into his likeness. What a vulnerable place to be seen and known. David affirms that God knows his inner and outer world, a world that before his time began was already seen. God knew that David would go on to struggle with lust, with his physical kingdom, and so on. God also knew that David would be a man after God's own heart. The struggles he would face and would succumb to didn't stop God from crafting and creating David. Whether or not the psalmist chose or wanted to give that knowledge to God of the things he struggled with, God already knew before he even breathed his first breath. In my many years of walking this earth, I've encountered many people who don't see themselves through the lens of this description. So often we worry and care about what other people know about us. It's easy to get caught up in the places that we feel like we might be missing things or we don't have a certain physique or what we should look like. Yet God's workmanship doesn't have mistakes. I think we don't celebrate that intricate knowledge enough. In the next few verses, we begin to see how immeasurable God's knowledge over his people is. Psalm 139:17-18 says, "How precious are your thoughts about me, O God? They cannot be numbered. I can't even count them. They outnumber the grains of sand, and when I wake up, you are still with me." In Hebrew, the emphasis is on the phrase "about me" in those verses. The thoughts that God has for humanity, even before they were born, cannot be numbered or quantified. His care for his creation is outside of this world. I can't even find the words to summarize it. We should go home. There's a delightful fellowship with David in verse 17. He can't count the thoughts. Imagine, he falls asleep trying to number the thoughts of God, but falls asleep and wakes up, and he's still counting. He's still with the Lord. God's knowledge is unquantifiable. And if we tried to count, we'd fail. We might even fall asleep trying if we tried it here. And he has room for knowledge about each and every one of us. There's not a limit to what fits in his knowledge. David goes on to own God's attitudes towards those who are not following his ways. In verses 19 to 22, he implores, "Oh God, if only you would destroy the wicked. Get out of my life, you murderers. They blaspheme you. Your enemies misuse your name. Oh Lord, shouldn't I hate those who hate you? Shouldn't I despise those who oppose you? Yes, I hate them with total hatred, for your enemies are my enemies." Here he takes on the heart of God with a repulsion towards God's enemies at the time. But the execution of God's judgment belongs to God. God's knowledge here is higher. He knows best. When the psalmist sees people living in ways that are not the path of God, he's frustrated, angry about these broken people and their choices. In this psalm, David moves from the harsh and strong language and transitions to a heart of asking God to seek his heart and look for any ways he may be wrong in the following verses, which brings us to our verse of the week, Psalm 139:23-24, the prayer of invitation that David makes to God. He calls out to God as he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you and lead me along the path of everlasting love." These verses are an echo of the opening verse where the psalmist calls out that God has searched and known him. Yet this prayer is an invitation on the psalmist's part to be searched and grown. This prayer is where we land today. God's knowledge is transformative. It changes the way in which we understand him and the invitation made in these verses. It's one of weight and complete trust. When we accept that he knows us and we can't get away from that knowing, when we acknowledge that his knowledge is protective from wherever we find ourselves, as we accept that he knows us so intricately that we can't even number the thoughts he has for each of us, when we see his thoughts as higher than our own, we can be in a place to invite him to explore and expose our areas of weakness. Here we are transformed. There is weight in the words, "Search me and know me." The knowing that God has over our lives is not in a "I see you from across the way through my binoculars," but in a close friend, caring overseer, supportive guide way. To be known can be one of the most scary and vulnerable things we are in this life. It can also be one of the most rewarding feelings that we ever feel. Anyone who has ever been in a relationship, friendship, or formed a connection with another person understands the risk that it takes to let people into our world to challenge, nurture, and grow us. Brené Brown, a well-known researcher and storyteller who's done extensive research on vulnerability, in her book Daring Greatly writes that vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. She goes on to write that if we want greater clarity in our purpose or deeper and more meaningful spiritual lives, vulnerability is the path. Through experiencing a vulnerable knowing from God, our lives are shaped differently. We open ourselves up to grow in belonging and courage, in joy, and deeper understanding not only of ourselves, but the way that God desires to lead us in. David invites God to, to test him and know his anxious thoughts and point out anything that offends him. I like the Living Bible translation has a phrase, it's worded a little differently, and it says, point out anything you find in me that makes you sad. These words from the psalmist ask God to keep looking inward into his heart, exposing any grit, any gristle that needs to be removed or polished, or things that are hurting his heart. This exposing of knowing used to overwhelm me. I used to envision me arriving to the end of my life and having a screen, probably bigger than this one, playing back all the things of my life, mostly the bad. There's a time Christina called her brother a less than favorable word. There's the time Christina botched it up in that friendship. Or yeah, that time I thought it would be smart to steal. Or that time I thought it would be smart to push that person with my words, push that person with my arms, walk away from someone with my strong sense of justice, and I could go on. I envisioned God sitting back and watching this home video of my screw-ups and shaking his head soberly as I shamefully sat there acknowledging my choices. I haven't died yet, and I can't say for sure what will happen in eternity. I will leave that complex message for Josh. But this I have grown to know. God knew that I would miss the mark, slip, fall, and say things that weren't wholesome long before I breathed my first breath. Yet he has still chosen to use me in some pretty weird and wild ways, in spite of my human finiteness. The final line of this prayer is, lead me along the path of everlasting love. God doesn't leave us in the breaking open of the areas of growth and change. He points us along in the way we should go, pursuing a life that honors him. I know I'm an anxious person. I'm the one who sits on an airplane and can overthink everything that could go wrong, from the engine stopping, to a scene from Lost happening, to the pilot having a health emergency, to there not being enough oxygen in the space for us all to breathe, and I can think of all of these things before I've even buckled my seatbelt. I'm a worrier. I read this prayer and easily think to myself that I don't need God to show me the anxious thoughts because I'm right here thinking them. But God doesn't want us to just be aware of them. He wants us to move towards a path of healing and growth. It's maybe not the healthiest way to live, constantly feeling that way. 1 Peter 5:7 says, give all your worries and cares to God, for he cares about you. He desires to see us living lives free of worries and anxious thoughts that don't need to be present. To some degree, we all worry. We're all anxious about things in this life. Money, job security, relationships, health are all prime examples of things that statistically breed anxiety. Yet when we ask God to show us the areas of anxiousness and to point out the ones that might need a little bit of growth, we're vulnerably inviting him to expose us to places that we might have been neglecting or ignoring. For many, you've prayed prayers like this, these verses over the years, inviting God to dig deeper and shape and grow you in a way that points to him. You've maybe experienced this leading in one way or another in your life. For others, this may be a new, odd concept to wrap your mind around. God knows everything and has given grace where you might not have known to give it to yourself before. There are three ways I believe this prayer can encourage us this morning. That through inviting God to search and know us, we're inviting in security for our insecurity. Eugene Peterson said it best in his book, A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. All the persons of faith I know are sinners, doubters, uneven performers. We are secure not because we are sure of ourselves, but because we trust that God is sure of us. Accepting that security in the midst of my own brokenness is what allows me to get up after I fail, and it's what allows me to stand here and share today. Some days I'm not too sure about the things that I think, worry about, fret about, and care about. Knowing that God knows all and is sure about me and how he's using me and growing me gives me a peace-filled confidence in who he is. God is most certain about each of us. He spent the time crafting us from our unformed selves and welcomes us in spite of our decisions to push back or to fall. He brings us security for our insecurity. Being known by God can bring comfort for any discomfort. God's knowing of our hearts and us should not breed worry and discomfort, but rather comfort. Am I insecure by times by the fact that God has knowledge of things that I've thought of, said, and done? You better believe it. Do I worry about it? Sometimes. Scratch that. A lot of the times. I've heard a line about worry that it's like being in a rocking chair. It gives us something to do, but it doesn't get us anywhere. God's knowing is comfort and meant for all of us. We can read familiar passages like Psalm 139 and think to ourselves that we truly believe God created humanity intricately, knows us well, and cares for us deeply, but we may uncomfortably choose to not include ourselves in that reading. God created everyone so beautifully, but me, nah, he was about to take his lunch break when he got to me. Everyone at work is so smart, driven, passionate, intelligent, but me, no, I think God carved that skill out of me. He didn't see those things in me. God's knowing of us and our invitation to ask him to search and know us can be comforting when we look at the outcome. Our next point of application this morning is that being known by God is an invitation to pursue refinement. We're not going to have it all together. I remember thinking once I figured out how to stop back-talking to my parents as a kid, I'd be sinless. My prayer life consisted of me asking God, cleanse me white from my sins, Lord, please cleanse me white from my sins. And then I'd get this clean slate of paper, and then I'd do it again. I'd talk back to my parents, and the next night I'd be like, Lord, I need the clean piece of paper. Like, it was a very weird, childish perspective of how forgiveness worked. And each time I'd get a white slate, and I'd be back in a word war with my parents, and the next night I'd be back asking for that again. Once I figured out the back-talking thing, or did I, Mom? I realized I wasn't going to be achieving this level of purity and maintaining it for life. Life is long. As soon as that issue resolved, I was face-to-face with other tween and teen angsty issues that came up. God knows these shortcomings, and he knows they will keep coming as long as we live on this side of eternity. Michael Iaconelli, in his book Messy Spirituality, writes about the, well, messy reality it is to be a spiritual person. I recommend reading this book if you wrestle with this notion of perfecting faith. It's really good. Brian and Nicole, if you're thinking you have this book, you don't. You donated it to a thrift store, and I bought it. You left your names inside. Okay. But the quote I wanted to share this morning from this book... But the quote I wanted to share this morning from this book is, do we encourage people to fail so they can grow? No. We encourage people to grow, which means they will fail. Refinement isn't always comfortable. Being known by God and always seen is not an invitation to pursue perfection so that he will only know the good stuff, but rather an invitation to grow. Will we fall? You better believe it. Will he see it and know? You bet. Will we be embarrassed? Probably. But as followers of Jesus, we actively get ourselves back up, we dust off the grit, and we keep, I'm going to use the word, hustling forward in pursuit of the path of everlasting life. These verses hold an invitation for God to refine. There are two tangible ways I can think of that this can be done, and that's one is in community. God points us to those areas of growth through other people. On the 11-month trip I completed back in 2016, feedback was a major part of the process. Every night, 6 days a week, we'd sit down in a circle and we'd share with one another areas of celebration of things that we saw the other people do well that day, and also the ugly areas of growth. We grew to value the heart and intent behind the words, even when it was said in a hurtful or exposing way of some of our areas of growth. Asking God to point out these areas in our life that are offensive or not our finest is a way of growing in a direction that is pleasing to him. Having people around us who can call us out is a splendid way to foster a heart willing and ready for refinement. God can speak to us through the words of other people that we trust. Through prayer, we can ask God to reveal to us what our areas of edginess are, the ones that might need fine-tuning or a little polishing. By praying these verses to memorize as a prayer inviting God to know us and search us, we are inviting in refinement, especially because by inviting God to reveal us these things, we're also knowing and growing in our understanding of ourselves. Through this invitation, we're seeking security within our insecurities, we're finding comfort for our discomfort, and we're pursuing refinement in our lives. To close this morning, before I pray, I want to read a quote by A.W. Tozer that's in your notes, I believe, that summarizes quite well this experience of God's knowing of our hearts, even when we don't know if we can handle what he might find or are wary of what might come out from our lives. And the quote says, "How unutterably sweet is the knowledge that our Heavenly Father knows us completely. No talebearer can inform on us. No enemy can make an accusation stick. No forgotten skeleton can come tumbling out of some hidden closet to abash us and expose our past. No unsuspected weakness in our characters can come to light to turn God away from us, since he knew us utterly before we knew him and called us to himself in the full knowledge of everything that was against us. He knows the good, the bad, the in-between, and through his knowing, he wants us to continually be drawing closer to him. We're going to pray. God, I thank you for the knowing that you have over our lives and the way that you see us, and you've seen us since before we can even remember or imagine, God. I thank you that your care for us was detailed, intricate, complex. I thank you that we aren't simple humans, that we are created uniquely and extravagantly by you. I pray that as we jump into our week this week, we can be praying this prayer in our lives of inviting you to search us and know us. So God, I pray that you search us and you know our hearts, that you test us and know our anxious thoughts, that you point out anything in us that offends you, and that you lead us along in the path of everlasting love. Amen.